From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, is the approval process for new airplanes broken?
The FAA has delegated increasing amounts of this work to industry. And when it comes to certifying new airplanes, that means to Boeing.
We'll ask Congressman Stephen Lynch. Plus, why does the achievement gap between low and high-income students persist? Also today, the cultural debate over meatless meat. Are you still a carnivore if you eat lab-grown meat? And can you eat it and still be a vegetarian? And we remember Boston native surf rock pioneer Dick Dale.
The song itself is an actual Egyptian folk song. Wayno Habibi, Wayno Habibi, Akfayen, where are you, my sweetheart? Habibi, your sweetheart.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Hundreds of Boeing 737 MAX jets remain grounded around the world today. The model has been involved in two deadly crashes in the past 5 months. As investigators in multiple countries work to determine the causes, there are questions here at home about the Federal Aviation Administration's relationship with Boeing. The Seattle Times reported over the weekend that FAA managers pushed the agency's engineers to delegate much of the safety testing responsibility to Boeing itself. The resulting safety analysis had crucial flaws, according to the newspaper. Meanwhile, the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee is promising to conduct, quote, rigorous oversight with every tool at our disposal to get to the bottom of the FAA's decision-making process. Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch is a member of that committee, and he joins us now. Congressman Lynch, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Callum. Good to be with you.
So, as I mentioned, the Seattle Times is reporting that both current and former engineers involved with the safety evaluation of the 737 MAX raised some red flags even before the Ethiopian Airlines crash. Specifically, they were concerned about a sensor that automatically points the nose of the plane down if it detects a threat of stalling. So were you concerned, Congressman, about how the FAA oversaw the development of this plane?
I am concerned, and there are also some physical indications at the crash site that the screw that actually raises and lowers the device to point the nose up or down was in the down position, so it was forcing the plane, even though it was in a rapid descent, the plane was the aileron, I guess, was in a position where it was forcing the nose down, even at that point.
This would be the screw on that horizontal part of the tail there that would, if the sensor detects the plane is going up too much, it's going to stall.
They call it a jack screw.
Right, right. And this would be a similarity, Congressman, perhaps, to the Lion Air crash in Indonesia 5 months ago.
That seems to be the indication right now. And I know that the Ethiopian transport minister, Mr. Moges, has said that there are similarities, but I'm not quite sure of that. That's his statement, but that's all that's out there right now. We don't have a formal accident report at this point.
So I guess the straightforward question is: the FAA too cozy with Boeing?
I do think that the FAA is overmatched by the engineering talent at Boeing. These are the very best. I think that over time, the quality of engineering talent at Boeing has sort of seeped into the relationship with the FAA in a way that they've taken over more of the responsibilities, sort of a regulatory capture, if you will, where Boeing is able to influence their own, their own regulatory protocols that are meant to hold their feet to the fire on some of this stuff. Some of the inspections have been delegated to Boeing personnel, and in other cases, they actually work hand in hand. So there's not really an impartial third party to sort of hold Boeing's feet to the fire on some of these protocols.
And the FAA has said that's largely because of a decline in funding. They say they don't have the manpower to do all the work themselves. Is that how you see it, Congressman? Or do you suspect maybe that there's some political pressure on the FAA to go easy on a domestic company like Boeing so they can compete with a European company like Airbus?
I think it's a bit of both. I think that I think there are limits that are put on the FAA. A lot of our regulatory agencies have suffered in recent years because of a decline in funding. So there is this truth in that. And also, there's a lot of lateral movement where someone who picks up a fair amount of skill within the FAA on aircraft design or regulation is easily pulled away to the private sector because they have that value. And the relationships as well. So that's having an effect as well. And yes, Boeing's a major U.S. manufacturer. So politically, they provide a lot of jobs. And so there is political pressure to treat them as a preferred U.S. manufacturer. That does happen. Yeah.
So should that be a higher priority for Congress then? I mean, if people are upset about the way the system is working and if they want the FAA to be more bringing more independent scrutiny to approving airplanes, does Congress need to act to appropriate more funds for it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there has to be a bright line distinction between, our inspector generals and the industry over which they supervise. So there has to be that demarcation. And it's become somewhat incestuous, I think, over time, because, Boeing's had an excellent record up to now. And generally, commercial air travel has been very, very safe. So, none of the red flags that normally would come from an industry that would invite enhanced scrutiny.
In addition to that Seattle Times report, the Wall Street Journal is reporting over the weekend that federal prosecutors and the Department of Transportation are also scrutinizing Boeing, and also that there's a federal grand jury in D.C. that has issued a subpoena to at least one person involved with the 737 MAX's development, and that was a day after the Ethiopian Airlines crash. I should say, Congressman, that's an unusual move. I mean, typically, if there's a crash like this, this might be a civil case. So I'm curious what you're hearing. I mean, do you think criminal charges are a real possibility and appropriate in this case?
I'm not sure yet, but I do agree. I do agree. That's highly unusual. This is usually a civil, investigation, and you're right. In this case, I think it was last Monday, the Justice Department Criminal Division actually, issued the subpoena, and they're on this right now. So that is highly unusual. Usually it's, an inspector general or a DOT inspector general usually does that type of work. So, that's highly unusual. And I'm not quite sure whether, criminal charges would be brought. But the fact that these people are handling it is certainly highly unusual.
What can we expect from your Transportation Committee, Congressman? Hearings? Will you be proposing legislation?
Certainly, I know that Chairman DeFazio has issued a full committee investigation that'll be happening. I think that there's a tug of war right now over the whole black box analysis, so we're waiting on that. I know I'm actually on the aviation subcommittee, so this is a core interest of mine. So I think the facts will lead us to where the legislation should go. I mean, if it is a case where our own regulatory scrutiny was dulled or diverted, then we got to drill down on that and reestablish those bright line distinctions between the regulator and the industry.
So we'll be waiting for those black box reports, and we're also, of course, waiting for the Mueller report, Congressman. I do want to ask you a bit about that while we have you. A new poll from USA Today and Suffolk University finds that support for the House to seriously consider impeaching the president has dropped. It's now down to about 28%. And, of course, we heard Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi saying just recently that she doesn't support impeachment proceedings at this point. She said it would have to be something that's so bipartisan you'd get Republicans on board. And this is a source of division in your own party, as you know. So where do you come down on? Are you with the Speaker?
Well, yeah, I would say my position is akin to hers, although not necessarily. I just think it should be an evidence-based process. We have given you know, we authorized Mr. Mueller to conduct this investigation. He has taken an enormous amount of time, and he's investigated, you know, dozens and dozens, if not 100 witnesses. He's taken much time to do this. I mean, we've done one hearing in our oversight committee with Mr. Cohen that lasted one day. And, you know, I think that Mr. Mueller has had much more access to evidence than we have. So I will wait for his report. If the evidence is there for impeachment, we will move on impeachment. If not, we will continue to investigate and see if there's anything else there.
But do you think, Congressman, that an evidence-based conclusion is even possible for the general public? I mean, that same poll I just referenced from USA Today also finds that half of people surveyed agree with the president that the Mueller investigation is a witch hunt. NPR is reporting that we're getting close to the end of this investigation. But I just wonder if you're worried that no matter what the findings are, people will just look at it through their own partisan lens.
Oh, I'm sure they will. I'm sure they'll look at it that way. But as lawmakers and, you know, as an attorney, there's a difference between, you know, evidence and popular opinion. So if the evidence is there to proceed, we will proceed.
And will you support release of the full Mueller report?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think that is foremost in my mind in terms of both being helpful to the public to understand the length and breadth of the investigation. And also, I just think so much of this has gone on behind the scenes and has been hid from the public. I think there's a civic dimension to this, to be able to look at what the facts are and what the evidence actually is.
One other bit of news today, Congressman. Three of your colleagues, Representatives Catherine Clark, Jim McGovern, Ayanna Pressley, they're going to a rally at Boston City Hall this afternoon to support the Dream and Promise Act, which would provide a permanent protection and path to citizenship for Dreamers, and also those with temporary protected status and deferred enforced departure. Will you support that legislation as well?
Oh, I'm signed on. I'm already co-sponsored. Yeah.
And while we're thinking about the new Congress, we're just a few months in, let me just give you the floor for a moment to say what other bills or initiatives are you pushing aside from those big, you know, high-profile ones that we've already discussed?
Well, I'm a new one of my new assignments is actually on the Transportation Committee. So we've got, and I'm on, as I mentioned before, aviation and then rail and also pipeline safety. So so we have a $1.5 trillion transportation bill that should come out by the end of June is now being discussed in Ways and Means. So that will address a lot of our needs, but in particular, what I'm dealing with locally is sort of this runaway oil industry and gas pipeline industry that we have no influence on. The Natural Gas Act was passed back in 1938. There hasn't been much of a change to that legislation for some time. And now we're seeing high-pressure pipelines being brought into thickly settled residential areas, which was never the case. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, accidents like we saw up in Andover and Lawrence. And we also see some projects that are coming online in Weymouth and West Roxbury where we think it is actually a physical danger to the residents in that area. So I would like to insert, I've already had legislation defeated twice that would actually give the public safety officer of our chief public safety officer, which in Massachusetts would be the fire marshal, the chief fire marshal for the state, the ability to basically overrule a project if he found that the threats to public safety were palpable and would direct the project back into review. So those are some of the I've also got some major problems with aviation. We've had this new next-gen RNAV system that puts these thousands and tens of thousands of commercial airline flights over the same houses, basically, each and every day, every week, every month of the year. So, and this is all done in the name of saving jet fuel. And what I would like to do is to, you know, take that system down and go to a more dispersed method of aircraft coming over, you know, residential neighborhoods in and around Logan Airport and some of the other busier airports in the country. So there's a lot there's a lot of work to be done. There hasn't been much oversight done. I'm on the oversight committee. And, you know, we've got young men and women in uniform in Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria. And we haven't had much on-the-ground review of what is happening in those places. So I think that's something that, that Congress has to tackle. We've got this debate over the new Green Deal and how, even though that document is aspirational largely, it's a, you know, it's a non-binding measure. I think, you know, the mechanics of how we get to where we need to be on environmental issues in this country and, you know, having a more evidence-based and logical approach to improving our environment, that's going to have to be engineered through the legislative process. So we have to start, you know, working on that issue in real time.
Aside from that, though, your agenda is wide open. So that's Massachusetts Congressman. Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch with a very full plate. Thank you, Congressman, for joining us today on Radio Boston.
Thank you, Calum. Good to be with you.
And before we break here, we do want to remember Boston native Dick Dale, who died over the weekend at age 81. He's known as a pioneer of surf rock, the king of surf rock guitar. You've more than likely heard this iconic song. That's Dale's 1962 version of Mizr Lou, which means Egyptian woman. It's an old folk song from the Middle East. Dale's version has had incredible staying power. It was featured in the cult classic Pulp Fiction in 1994, and then heavily sampled by the Black Eyed Peas in their 2005 song, Pump It. Born Richard Anthony Mansour of Lebanese-American descent, Dale spent his childhood years right here in Boston. But it was in California that he found his musical groove. Here's Dale with NPR back in 2010, talking about his family's 1954 move from Massachusetts to Orange County, where he learned to surf and started a band after winning an Elvis singing contest.
I didn't realize it was Elvis songs for the Yackel Oldsmobile. So my dad says, look at the spotlights, let's go in there. And we went in there, and I had my red jacket on, you know, my black pants, and I started singing, baby, let me be bumped, doa-doa. And then I found out, I get a call from the state theater manager, and he says, you have won, Dick Dale. You're going to come and sing with between the Elvis movies. And all I had was this one little guitar and a little Flash Gordon microphone and about a 6-inch speaker. And that's how I started rolling and doing that.
So, in honor of Dick Dale, let's surf into this break with the song Nitrous off his 1996 album, Calling Up Spirits. Stay with us. I'm Callum Borchers. There's more Radio Boston after the break.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. For decades, education experts and advocates have tried to close the nationwide achievement gap between low and high-income students. Yet, a new study finds the gap is still as wide as it was half a century ago. The study appears today in Education Next, an academic journal published by Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Professor Paul E. Peterson is senior editor of Education Next and a co-author of the study. He's also the Henry Lee Shattuck Professor of Government and Director of the Program on Education Policy and Governance at Harvard's Kennedy School. And he joins us now on the line. Hello.
Well, Callum, thank you for asking me to join your show.
Well, we're glad that you're here, Professor Peterson. And I'm wondering if you can begin by just telling us what led you to this study. Were you just sort of investigating a hunch or something else?
Well, there had been some previous work in this area that had shown that the achievement gap between the very highest income group and the very lowest income group had widened dramatically over the last 50 to 75 years. And I thought the data was rather limited. There was only 12 studies that it was based on. So since I knew we had this information for a much larger number of data points, actually 98, we said, well, let's find out whether or not that finding is correct. And I thought we would find a closing of the achievement gap. But no, we found that it just stayed the same. It hasn't changed over the 50-year period.
I see. And as you know, some of the academics who have previously found a widening achievement back have criticized your work. But either way, the results aren't all that encouraging, whether the gap is as wide as it has been or getting worse. And I just wonder if you have a theory, if you were able to figure out in your work what the cause is. I mean, why isn't the gap getting closer?
Well, it's we feel more confident about actually documenting exactly how wide the gap is. It's about 3 to 4 years worth of learning when you reach the age of 15. That's a pretty large gap between the top 10% and the bottom 10%. And if you just look at the top 25%, the bottom 25%, it's still about 2.5 to 3 years wide. So it's a very wide gap that doesn't close at all. And why it doesn't close, that is, you know, you might say, well, nothing has changed over that time period. But we think things have changed. I mean, there's been a tremendous effort to close the gap by the school system, and the federal government has sponsored compensatory education programs and Head Start programs, and there's been a lot of state laws that have tried to redistribute resources more effectively to low-income school districts. But this may all be offset by the fact that there's been a change in the structure of the teaching force, that talented women are finding other professions that they're going into, and it's harder and harder to attract a talented teaching force.
Well, so talk to me a little bit more about the theory about the degradation, perhaps, of the quality of teaching, because that's one of the factors you highlighted in your study, but I'm not sure how you would solve that problem, right? Because if you have women with more career opportunities now who previously were confined to teaching, that's not something we want to go back to, right? So how else could we address the lack of an ability to close this gap?
Well, other countries do have much more talented teachers than we have. I mean, we rank very low as compared to other major countries in the level of talent among teachers. So, and how do they do it? Well, first of all, they make sure that they identify talented women and then attract them into schools of education. Whereas we have 1,500 schools of education in the country, and the elite institutions of our society don't provide training for teachers, and the very least selective higher education institutions rely on their teacher education program as a way of surviving. So we've got a sort of a completely wrong-headed way of recruiting people into education. So that's one thing that we really need to change. And the second thing is we should be paying teachers in the same way that women are being paid in other major professions. They're paid according to their merit. Whereas in education, you slowly get a little bit more money each year that you teach, but the meritorious teacher doesn't get any special rewards. So it's really not much of an incentive to go into teaching if you're a talented person.
I know that aside from the quality of instruction, you also looked at resources that are available to someone in the home. You examined things like whether a child has his or her own bedroom, for example, or whether there's a TV or a computer in the home. And remember, this goes back decades, so there was a time when those were sort of novelties. So were you using that strictly as sort of proxies to determine the family's wealth, or were there specific factors that weighed on the student's academic performance?
Well, we actually say that we are comparing the haves to the have-nots.
Mm-hmm.
And the haves are haves because their parents have more education. They have a college degree. They have advanced education, perhaps. And also they have more material possessions in the home available to the student. That's what the student tells the interviewer when they take the test. So yes, that's how we document that there is this wide gap. And now, are there changes in society that may have contributed to the perpetuation of this gap? Well, they tend to go in two different directions. On the one hand, people are staying in school a lot longer, and so we've actually closed the educational attainment gap. So we have many more people with high school diplomas now than we ever had 50 years ago. And we also have a widening income gap. So income is moving in one direction and education is moving in another. And from my point of view, the society, the trends out there in society are pretty much a wash. There isn't a lot of clear indication of things moving in one direction or another. For example, we have much better nutrition today than we had many years ago. We have much better medical services today. They're much more egalitarian today than they once were. So there's a lot of positive things that have happened in society that should have helped to close the gap. There are some negative things in society that might have opened the gap, and the big negative would be the widening of the income gap.
Professor Paul E. Peterson's research appears today in Education Next. He's a co-author of the study and also the senior editor there, and he's the director of the Program on Education Policy and Governance at Harvard's Kennedy School. Professor Peterson, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for asking me to join you, Callum.
All right, let's bring in someone who has been studying educational disparities in Greater Boston and how to alleviate them for a long time. Barbara Field is a member of the Black Educators Alliance of Massachusetts and the former head of the Office of Equity in the Boston Public School System, and she joins us now on the line. Hello there, Barbara.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well. So we were just speaking with Professor Peterson about his study that was published today, and he talked about some of the factors that he thinks may be contributing to the persistent gap between low and high income students. What's your theory about why that gap persists today?
I believe the gap persists around one key factor, and that is the access to opportunity. When we talk about the achievement gap, we really are talking about an opportunity gap, and that opportunity is often measured by whether you have wealth or poverty. Those who have wealth are able to provide all of the resources that their family, their children, students need, whereas those who do not have that wealth do not have access. And that means because our schools are under-resourced, which is a mechanism by which we say that we will level the playing field. But that is not happening. We have seen our school budgets be slashed. We have seen our schools closed so that there is not the continuity around students having access to quality teachers, to a rigorous curriculum, to the arts, to all of the things that students need to progress. You cannot close schools because you say a school is underperforming when it is under-resourced, and then move students about two and three times before they even reach high school and think that they are going to excel in the same way that students who have all those resources, they have science labs, they have language labs. They have access to all kinds of programs, STEM programs. And then you're going to try to measure that through a test, which is not the real measurement for student performance, nor for school performance. And I think the reforms, the educational reforms that have been put forth are dealing with everything except what the real issue is. And what it is dealing with is the correlation between wealth, poverty, and how our students are faring on these tests. And that then pushes our schools to do test prep instead of educating our students in the way they should be educated, with schools that have the resources and the mechanisms and teachers with the support that they need to make that happen.
You know, you mentioned the quality of teaching, and we were talking about that with Professor Peterson as well. You know, his studies suggested that a part of the decline in the quality of teaching, assuming that it exists, it could partly because of opportunities available to women, women previously who would not have had professional opportunities who went into teachers. And there are those who say the evidence for this theory is kind of thin. So I'm curious what you see in this space.
Well, in this space, I see that, number one, we need to stop teacher bashing and putting everything at the foot of teachers and not look at how the larger society is failing in putting those resources in place. I think that teachers are asking for professional development. I think teachers are not just women, even though that's the majority of teachers, it's men as well. And I really think that we are not looking at what the real issues are. And, you know, to lay it at the foot of just women shows to me a lack of understanding of who's in our schools. And also we really need to be promoting men coming into teaching because our boys need to see men. They also need to see in those urban centers and throughout, they need to also see men and women of color teaching. So it's much more complex than, you know, just looking at women through the eyes of what he or she or whoever is doing it may think women need, but to look at what our schools and our children need.
You know, as you were talking about opportunities a moment ago, I was struck by the fact that you were talking about sort of everyday things like access to a STEM curriculum, because we were just talking about the extreme opportunity example last week with that very high-profile college admissions scandal, right, where parents were paying large sums of money to get their kids admitted to elite schools. Those are probably a very, let's hope, it's a very small percentage of what's going on. But you're seeing things, I take it, even from your time on the ground in the school system, right, to much more everyday problems that rear their head.
Definitely. And I think what was exposed around the school college admission test, I think it's just the tip of the iceberg. But I think it is an example of how we talk about merit is the factor that opens the doors or should open the doors. And we have negative conversations around affirmative action, but we don't talk about the kind of affirmative action that was exposed with this admissions scheme that was going on. We don't talk about the fact that if you have money and your parents can pay for a building on a college campus, that gives you access. We don't talk about if you're parent works at a college, you then have access, and it's free access when you have money. We don't talk about those things when we talk about access. And so the old saying, the rich gets richer, the poor gets poorer, because the poor do not have access. You know, they're more going by merit in some instances than those who have money, because they can't afford to buy a good score on an exam. You know, they can't afford to buy a building, pay for a building so they can get in. They can't do that to access the elite colleges and universities, which takes us into the quality of teaching. Who is to say that those who attend elite colleges and universities are more equipped and more prepared to teach our children than those who go to some of the other colleges and universities? Because for me, the question is still there, who's getting in, how are they getting in, and how are they staying in, and how equal is that playing field?
Right, even if you can't buy a building, maybe you can buy some test prep, and that can be a real advantage as well.
Exactly, or you can take all of the prep that your parents, you know, can buy. You don't even have to pay for someone to give you the right score on the test. But you can take all that preparation. And in Boston, we see that happening often with our entrance to the exam schools. And so then we try to mitigate that by giving our students more prep. But then with the prep comes not having the arts, the music, theater, all of the other coursework that one needs to be a well-rounded student. So this is a complex issue, but money is definitely, and wealth is there to, you know, determine who gets what and who benefits from what. And until we address the under-resourcing of our schools, then we're not really looking at this issue through the right lens. And therefore, I think that's why we see stagnation or a little increase or a little decrease in the achievement gap, because the opportunity gap we have not addressed, and we have not yet funded our schools so that all students get the resources. And that's the course offerings, you know, that's the smaller class sizes, that's an adequate facility and not having it rain on children, that those who are from wealthy families benefit and experience every day.
Barbara Fields is a member of the Black Educators Alliance of Massachusetts and the former head of the Office of Equity for Boston Public Schools. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. The college admissions cheating scandal that Boston federal prosecutors revealed last week relied heavily on testing accommodations that are typically reserved for students with disabilities. The alleged ringleader had parents fraudulently apply for things like extra time and a special testing facility to have access to paid-off proctors. As WBUR's Carrie Young reports, some students with disabilities worry the scandal could make it even harder to get what they need to take standardized tests.
When computer scientist Chloe Kleiman-Silver heard the news about the cheating scandal last week, it made her mad.
It is really unfair that this is something that money can buy you.
Kleiman-Silver has a sensory processing disorder that makes spatial coordination and handwriting difficult. When the Brown University graduate took the SAT in high school, she applied for two accommodations: the use of a laptop for the essay section and the ability to circle her answers in the test booklet rather than fill in bubbles.
It was really hard for me to get accommodations, and I had to go through lots of testing. And the first time I tried to get the accommodations, the SAT board only accepted half of them.
Kleiman-Silver worries about blowback from the scandal, and that increased scrutiny could make it harder for students like her. She and many others argue the current process is already difficult.
It's a lot of work to get accommodations, you know. It really is. There's a lot of different pieces involved.
That's Kathy Ledger, the director of the school guidance department at Brockton High School.
It's a legal document. Teachers sign off on it. We have to have documentation from the medical field, whether it's a neurologist, a physician, and then I have to send that in to the college board where they have to approve it.
She says the school does help families coordinate the pieces needed to prove their case to standardized test administrators like the college board. But she adds it's still up to parents to get all of the documents.
It's overwhelming for a lot of our parents, but we help them get through the process.
That's a struggle that Wheaton College senior Jessica Chaikoff is currently in the middle of. She wants to go to grad school and needs to take the GRE for her applications. Chaikoff has a hearing impairment. She spoke to us through an adapted cell phone for this story.
It's been a long struggle for me to get my accommodations.
She says it took her 2 months and three different doctor visits to get all of the necessary paperwork together. Chaikoff wishes standardized testing was more accessible to people with disabilities.
It is really challenging to go through this process just to get what we need.
Officials with the College Board are defending their process. In a statement, they say the organization has a robust system in place to prevent cheating and always takes the necessary steps to ensure a level playing field. The nonprofit added there have been more disability accommodation requests over the last few years, but it says that's because more students are choosing to take the SAT or ACT.
That report from WBUR's Carrie Young. there's a growing cultural debate over meatless meat. It comes with the move to replace meat with meat-like products made from plants, wheat, and some interesting ingredients. Scientists are also developing lab-grown meat. All that has some people hopeful that alternatives to eating actual animals will help the environment, animal welfare, and individual health. But the movement has brought about a question. Will changing definitions of meat affect how we think about our values? That's the question posed by Irene Lee, co-owner of Mei Mei Restaurant, author of the Double Awesome Chinese Cookbook, and food columnist for WBUR's Artery. And Irene joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Irene.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what do we know about the different kinds of meatless meat and what they're actually made of? You take something like an Impossible Burger, maybe it's impossible to understand all the ingredients that are in it. What do we know about the options?
So the Impossible Burger is completely plant-based, and one of the interesting aspects is that it, quote, bleeds like a real burger.
And so, it looks pink?
Yes, exactly. So when you're working with it as a cook or a chef, it feels and smells and looks a lot like real ground beef. And then, of course, when you cook it, you can cook it to medium rare, slice it open, and it's juicy in the middle. So there's an ingredient called heme, which is soy-based, and that is where that sort of bleeding sort of effect comes from. And I think the Impossible Burger, the folks who make it would like to say it's a pretty straightforward, you know, it has wheat and soy and potato. But definitely there are a lot of big words on that ingredients list. And some of them have not been consumed in large quantities, you know, by humans before. So there's some question about whether those ingredients are really safe and how they're made. And for a lay person, you know, we'll probably never really understand.
Well, and you write for WBUR's Artery about some of the questions that we still don't know. That's one. Another one is the environmental impact, right? Because sometimes there's perhaps a lot of use of fossil fuels to grow some of these plants to make the meat alternatives through conventional processes. And so it's not entirely clear that the carbon footprint will actually be lower in all cases, right?
Right. It's not so black and white. And I think one of the really interesting things when we talk about eating less meat, we're really talking about eating less industrially farmed meat. So factory farms. And of course, meat can be raised in all sorts of different ways. So at Mei Mei, for example, we focus on meat that is from animals raised on pasture. So basically, they get to live their lives outside. They're part of a more closed-loop ecosystem. And so when we think about meat alternatives, we're sort of talking about turning away from one very specific thing, which has this terrible carbon footprint, which is industrialized animal farming. But you're absolutely right. When we start looking at where all these ingredients come from for alternative meats, all of the energy and resources required to culture meat in a lab, strand by strand, we really don't know what the environmental impact of that could be.
Right. So when you talk about the cultured meat, this could be, in some cases, it is a meat product in the sense that it is meat flesh of some kind. It's meat cells, but it was never a living, breathing animal. And so I'm curious about that question that we were teasing earlier on. I mean, would that even count if you called yourself a vegetarian, but you were eating meat cells that were grown in a laboratory? It was never a living animal. So are you still a vegetarian if you're eating that?
That's a great question. As not a vegetarian myself, I can't speak to it. But I think that for most vegetarians, that seems to cross a certain line. And so the Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat and even lab-grown meat are really aimed at converting meat eaters to folks who eat less meat.
Okay, so how effective is that on the taste scale, right? I mean, this is really the key question if you are a meat lover. Now, if you don't eat meat because of ethical reasons or environmental reasons, perhaps you've already chosen something else. But if you are someone who's going to have a hard time giving up meat, tell us as a chef, I mean, does it come close? I mean, you have some delicious pork on your menu. Can you replicate that with something else?
Well, I think the smart thing about the Impossible Burger and products like it is that ground meat is a lot easier to approximate with plant-based proteins than I think, for example, a juicy steak would be. And so for a substitute for a hamburger, I think it does just great. And the question remains open, will these companies be able to develop sort of whole muscle fabricated meat products that can replace all of those other formats that we love to eat meat in?
You know, one of the things that was really striking to me about your latest piece was the culture around eating that you talk about, specifically when it's tied to meat. You use the example of a Thanksgiving Day turkey. There's so much history and family wrapped around that concept that, as you said, doesn't really seem to work as well with a tofurkey. Maybe
exactly.
It does for some families, but that would be a tough conversion for mine and I think for a lot of
mine
folks.
Mine too.
So how do we tackle that? I mean, there's so much else wrapped up into our eating aside from just what's on the plate itself.
Definitely. I think that when we eat, we're making a statement about our own values, about the people we are eating with. And I think that, you know, this is a great opportunity for us to really examine how we translate our values into what's on the table, particularly as we start thinking about, you know, what is the real environmental impact of being vegan or vegetarian? You know, is meat grown in a lab ethical in a way that meat that comes from a living animal isn't? And so there are a lot of cultural assumptions, I think, that we have about what it means to be vegan or vegetarian and what those values underpinning those diets are. But there's a lot of room for rethinking that.
So you must constantly be thinking about what you're going to do for your next seasonal menu, because I know that Maymay doesn't serve the same thing all year round, right? And so as you're sourcing your ingredients, how are you thinking about these questions? You know, where you're going to bring things in responsibly, whether it's a meat product or an alternative?
Well, I'll actually share that we have always worked on serving less meat than sort of an average restaurant, because I think more or less we agree that eating less meat in general would be a good thing. And so on our menu, you'll see that meat is a filling in a dumpling, or it's turned into a hash, or it's just one component in a sandwich that has lots of stuff in it. So in lots of non-Western cultures, having meat as a seasoning or just a small component of a balanced dish is pretty typical. So we're trying to do that. We also tried out Impossible Meat in a dumpling format, and it tasted pretty good, but I think the consensus among our team was that there was just something not quite right about it for us.
I see. So sometimes it just is maybe better to just pick an alternative that you know is different. I recently had a sandwich at your place that was, it featured a sweet potato. It's essentially almost like a steak, right? It was the sort of feature filling in that sandwich.
Exactly.
It wasn't going to fool me into thinking it was meat, but it was, you know, sort of filling that function.
Yeah, and I think that there are all sorts of ways to cook with real vegetables, not plant-based meat alternatives that are really delicious and ecologically friendly and don't require all of those inputs, all of that processing. You know, we peel the sweet potato and we cook it. So that's pretty straightforward. And with these meats, one of the things I wrote is that they don't really pass the Michael Pollan test, which is, would your grandmother recognize it as food? And are there ingredients that you don't know how to pronounce? And in the case of a lot of meat alternatives, the answer is no and yes, respectively.
Got it. I want to ask you about another piece that you've been very busy for us lately. And before writing about lab-grown meat and meat alternatives, you were also writing about immigrant-owned restaurants. And this line stood out to me. In immigrant-owned restaurants, diners' perceptions of authenticity correlate with low prices and high online ratings. Explain that. Why is that perception problematic?
Well, I think that as somebody who owns a Chinese-American restaurant, we deal with the assumption on the part of our diners that they're going to come in and the food is just going to be really cheap. And in some cases, it just doesn't matter how good the food is or the reasons for why it's so expensive. As soon as they see it's Chinese and it's not basically, you know, a bargain, then they're kind of out the door. And so for when we think about wanting Boston to have a more diverse and interesting restaurant scene, I think we have to consider, you know, what are we incentivizing? And for a lot of restaurant owners, it's a safe bet to make sort of cheap, reliable food. And so doing a high-end version of pho, for example, I don't know how well that would go over. People complain when pho is $12. Lots of people don't complain about pasta that's twice that much for even less food. But I think that there is a bias against sort of immigrant cuisines and especially those from the global south, which is authentic means cheap. And if it's not cheap, then it's not authentic, which means it can't be good.
And I imagine one of the issues there is that those diners' expectations lead to pressure on the restaurateurs to buy cheap ingredients and to pay very low wages.
Exactly. And, you know, in the past, there have been studies and writing about how cheap food necessitates cheap ingredients and cheap labor. And of course, to the extent that immigrant restaurant owners employ other immigrants, that creates this sort of alternate economy that is very challenging for business owners and for workers.
All right. Last question. Some of our listeners may have read that piece in the New York Times over the weekend about fire cider. And I know this is something you have on your menu. You've had it for a while. And there's this wrestling over who owns the term. Does anyone own the term? There is one company in particular in Pittsfield that believes they should be able to copyright it and it is theirs. Where do you come down on this? I mean, can something like fire cider even be copyrighted?
I think for me, it feels a little ridiculous to copyright something like fire cider. It would be like copywriting, I don't know, lemonade or iced tea or an Arnold Palmer. And when it comes to food, you know, intellectual property is kind of a gray area. You can't really copyright a recipe in the way that you can copyright other things. So I love the idea that food and recipes are a place that is very open source and that we can share and we should share with each other. So for me, I think let's all keep making fire cider. We can make it the way we want. We can buy theirs in a bottle if we like. And, you know, hopefully we can all get along.
Maybe Arnold Palmer owns the copyright to the Arnold Palmer. But aside from that, I don't think anybody else could make the claim. That's Irene Lee, co-owner of Meme and head chef. She's also the food columnist for WBUR's Artery and author of the new cookbook, Double Awesome Chinese Food. Irene, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, Eve Zukoff, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.